A gracious good evening, you guys. Well, this is the second part of the adventure of this transition here in the Old Testament between the history that really was God dealing with Gentiles and had really not much at all to do with him dealing with his chosen nation. These are the two chapters, 10 and 11, that make that transition. As you recall, the story up till now, the first nine chapters are pretty much, it's the creation, it's the fall, it's the flood, it's all the things that we learn in our flannel graphs in Vacation Bible School when first we went. But what's really going on here, if that is the primeval history of Genesis, its single overriding theme is that we have fallen and can't get up, as we said last week. But it's the fact that when God allows us a chance over and over again, we simply, as a race, are not able to choose good. We just don't. Cain murders his brother. Even Noah gets drunk. Ham messes up and gets cursed. The Nephilim and, gosh, was it Russell Crowe have trouble? There's something in there about that, I forget. But it's not a good situation. It's just we can't get ourselves out of trouble. And that is the lesson of chapters 1 through 9. It's setting us up to learn that even though God continues to give us the opportunity, we just can't make the bar. This sets the stage for what he's about to do here in Babel. Now, we remember last week that chapter 10, by going through the genealogy of the sons of Noah, which really, if you count them down, actually amounts to 70 nations, what this was primarily intended to do was to emphasize for us the primacy of family. Now, we take family seriously in our day and age, and we know that it's important, but I want you just to, for just a couple seconds, soften your cerebellum and let it receive a couple of impressions from the ancient world. It wasn't just important back then. It determined who you were. It determined what would happen to you. It determined what you would do. Who you'd marry, where you'd live, very often how you'd die was determined by the family you were born into. Gosh, even up until recent times, in class societies in the Middle Ages, you know, if your daddy was a blacksmith, then you were a blacksmith. And if they were potato farmers, then you were potato farmers. And if you got a sudden dream and yearned to go to Hollywood and become an artist and oils and paints, that's just not happening. You're going to be a potato farmer. And not only that, if your daddy owed money or your grandfather owed money, you still owed that money. It absolutely sets you in concrete who your family was. Now, that's in this day and age, that has become less and less the case, but it still stamps us. You know, if you grew up in a bad home, an abusive parent, you know, children of alcoholics, or it was poor, or multiple divorces or something like that, you probably still carry the scar tissue and the emotional baggage of the hurt of that. And no show of hands, but I'll bet you it's at least half of us sitting here carry something hurtful from that time. So the family we belong to is still important. And what we ended up seeing is that really we've been given the opportunity to be members of a new family. And we race over that as we read this genealogy. But the fact is, that's more than just an escape hatch. It's an offer to change your identity, your history, and your destiny forever. It's huge. It's really beyond our understanding. I don't know if you know it, but we're here because our great 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 grandfather Adam messed up. That's why we're here. Now, I'm sure that we would have chosen to do the same stupid thing that he did, but the fact is, that's original sin. We carry that physically and spiritually because he and Eve messed up. We're stuck with it. Now, by the time we're 1.5 years old, we have certainly earned the right to be called guilty of sin in our own right. You know, I remember my nephew, I think he's about 2.5 years old years ago, and we're just exasperated, telling him to, now stop hitting your sister, you need to be good. And he just screwed up his face and, I'm not be good, I'm not. I just said, well, there it is, the human race. Oh my goodness. Well, you guys, this is why when Jesus in Luke 14 tells us to, that whoever does not hate his mother and father and sister and brother in comparison to his love for me, this is what he's talking about. He's saying, you guys, that natural family that you were born into, yes, I do want you to love them, but I want you to understand what I'm offering you. What I'm offering you is a new life, a new birth, and a new family. And if you don't love me more than you love your natural family, you're going to make a mistake. You're going to choose poorly on down the line. Well, that was the big lesson from last week. This week sets us up for something entirely different. The final failure of man. I was thinking for a fancy way to say this. This is what I would describe as the threshold event that clicks the automatic program into place whereby God's redemption plan and focusing his narrow focus on Israel actually begins. He's let the Gentiles go far enough and click. They hit that point, the wheels go, the gears turn, the circuit is closed, and the whole process of selecting, building, choosing, and redeeming a nation for himself begins. And it begins in chapter 11. Well, chapter 11 opens, of course, with the story of the Tower of Babel, the scattering of nations, given one last opportunity as a race of Gentiles. We, of course, immediately screwed up. We challenge God. We build the tower. Humanity fails. We seek to elevate ourselves. We challenge his dominion in heaven, and we pay the price for that foolishness. As we go through these, if you study at all, especially if you listen to PBS or Discovery Channel, I can't stand to watch those Bible programs on history. I can good for about 90 seconds, and then I get very unchristian in my attitudes. But you should know, because you're not going to hear it on PBS and you're not going to hear it on Discovery Channel, the mountain of evidence that supports the biblical accounts of what's going on. Something you won't hear is the ancient Sumerian epic, Enmerkar, also records this sudden confounding of a single tongue that everybody speaks, and all of a sudden they're speaking in different tongues. This is from the Sumerians. That would be enough, but so does the Akkadian story of Atraharas, which is recorded for us in stone. Also about the second millennium says, no, we were all speaking one language, and then all of a sudden everybody was talking different. What's up with that? So when people characterize these stories as, oh, that's just the Bible telling us little flanograph stories, no. No, this has extra-biblical corroboration in the literatures and sacred recordings of many cultures, just as the flood does. This is as real as it gets, you guys. This really happened. So I just remember that as we go through it. Well, if that's how it opens, with the Tower of Babel, the scattering of the nations, it closes with the presentation of another line of Shem's descendants. You probably remember that Shem's great-great-grandson, Eber, had two sons, Peleg and Joktan. I love those names. Now, Joktan's sons were listed last week, you'll remember. They were among the people who are to be scattered. Remember, we read that whole line of descendants and genealogies. We were actually reading the last page first, because it was talking about them being assigned to territories according to their tribe and their language. Chapter 10 was actually the result of what we're about to read tonight. But Peleg's descendants are the only ones that weren't in chapter 10. Something else is going on with them, and we're going to read about it. God has a very special plan for this family. As it says in Matthew 1:1, this is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, and so the son of Peleg. God has chosen this line of family, well, who knows why, and out of this line, he's going to bring the Savior who's going to take care of what we couldn't do on our own. I love this, just in case anybody asks. I spent about 6 hours drawing where the different people went in the Mediterranean. I love this stuff. I get paid to do this. Can you believe that? Anyway, if you guys want to see that, actually, just for fun, Japheth's guys mostly ended up around the Black Sea, Japheth's family. Ham's family, most ended up on the Nile River and along the north coast of Africa, really where, you know, Libya and Egypt and Jordan, Canaan, where all the Islamic peoples are. I wonder if it disturbs them that their forefather was named Ham. I'm sorry. Come on, let's get serious. This is a Bible study, people. Okay. If you want to turn to Genesis chapter 11, verse 1, let's go through this because we got some interesting stuff to touch base on here. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. I don't know how many people we're talking about here. It can't be a huge number. It was just a couple generations after the flood. And it came about, as they journeyed east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. The land of Shinar, that plain is, it's where Baghdad is now. It's just Mesopotamia, the fertile land between the two rivers that we all studied in the third grade. Now, I'm not sure how many of the people are journeying east. It's very likely that as they grew and the tribe got bigger, they ran into problems like Abraham and Lot and his guys did. Remember, there wasn't enough grazing land, and so they finally had to split up. It wouldn't surprise me if they just started moving east to see if they could find better pastures, and of course they did. They're likely coming from northern Syria, Iraq, maybe Turkey. That's where the Ark supposedly was found. Remember, on Mount Ararat in eastern Turkey? Yeah, it makes sense. That could happen. Now, if we could read this literally, it would place Cush's son, Nimrod, at the head of this troop, about 100 years after the flood. But remember, as we talked about last time, the ancient genealogies, they weren't too concerned with getting everybody's name in there, and they weren't too concerned with being exact about the intervals. As long as you made sure to get David in there, get Solomon in there, get Abraham in there, as long as the important names were included, they were happy. And as we saw last time, they would cut it off after seven names. They would take the seven most important names. That counted as a complete genealogy. You know, that was your credentials. You could pass that into somebody and get a government job, I suppose. But we can't read them literally, and that makes it a little problematic. I'm guessing that the account we're reading tonight, I'm just going to take a stab at maybe 3500 BC. That would position it to be foundational to the development of the Sumerian and ancient Egyptian civilizations that followed. It's a mess if you get into this. I mean, you know, because the secular scholars butt heads with the biblical scholars, and they butt heads with the archaeologists. It's, I took a biblical archaeology magazine for about 2 years, and then I just got tired of everybody yelling at each other, and I stopped. So it's, never mind, don't worry. Number three here. And they said to one another, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, they settled there, and they said one to another, come, very emphatically, like a command. Well, if it's Nimrod, he probably is emphatically commanding. Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. This was important to them. One, the author here, Moses, is probably addressing an ancient Hebrew audience that normally is used to just, remember how they build? They just take the stones laying around, and they just kind of stack them. They call this dry stack. In masonry language, that's not what the Akkadians are doing. They got no stones laying around. They have to build bricks, just as the Hebrews would do later in Egypt. So this just lets them know how they do it. Did you notice the Akkadians actually had a ceremony when they were going to build a wall or a temple or a palace or a building? They would actually have the ceremony of blessing the first brick. And the priests would come out and make the brick, and they'd lift it up to the gods and everything. It was a big deal. Now you remember what we do is we either cut the ribbon or we dig the first shovel full of dirt. I'm just letting you know here. Number four, he said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Why would God take offense at that? Any ideas? Oh, come on, you guys. Have fun with me. I mean, you know. Well, they did want to make a name for themselves, and that would usurp God's prerogative. Remember what he told Abraham later on, chapter 12. I will make your name great. As part of the promise, I will make a nation of you. Your posterity will be more than the sands of the beach, the sea, or the stars of the sky. So that was definitely one. They're actually resisting being scattered abroad. Remember, he just told Noah, I want you to fill the whole earth. Now that you've survived this mess, take these animals, go, be happy, fill the entire earth. Well, there's a second one. And frankly, the fact that they're building a tower that's supposed to reach up into heaven, I'm thinking he could interpret that as a violation of the separation of the expanses, as we read about it in Genesis. You guys know this is a ziggurat, right? Everybody have seen pictures on Google of ziggurat? You know, it's like a big giant spiral staircase is basically what it is, built out of mud and brick. The only problem is structurally, as it winds up, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So the bigger the base, the taller it can be. Now, I got buddies that come back from being deployed in the sandbox who actually got to see some of these. We don't have any that are in really good shape anymore, but they could get to be 300 feet pretty easily. And they'd usually have a little shrine on the top, a little room where the priest could go in and offer the stuff and be out of everybody's sight. And just for fun, I just learned today that they actually would paint those light blue. So from a distance, the priest would go in and he'd disappear into the sky. Yeah, interesting stuff. It's just cool. Now, in case you're thinking that these were humble offerings to God, they had names, each of the ziggurats. One was called the Temple of the Foundation of Heaven and Earth. One was called the Gates of the Gods. So these are pretty well conscious efforts to steal God's glory and to come right out and say, well, this is where it's happening. Okay, verse 5. I just had to share all that ziggurat stuff with you guys. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. It's interesting, this really tall tower, and he has to actually come down even to see it. But that's okay. That's all right. And verse 6, and the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they begin to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Do you think the Lord is feeling anxiety here? No, he's not worried. They're not. You know what he's worried about? They're going to trash the earth. What he's saying is that when these guys get together, they're on the same page, they're following the same plan, they will trash my creation. And I'll have to start all over again. That's what he's thinking here. So he says in verse 7, come, let us go down. And there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. Now, just for fun, little aside, do you notice the plural pronoun? As if there were more than one person speaking in the Godhead. Oh, that probably doesn't mean anything. Okay, verse 8. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. You know, that is the condition that has prevailed since then, with a couple of small interruptions. Do you guys remember Acts 2? The Lord kind of reverses this, doesn't he? And now they're all speaking in languages that they each understand. So for his own purposes, God can reverse this burden. But for his purposes, he has visited upon humanity a condition that makes it hard even to live as neighbors, much less when you get to the frontier of the nation that lives next door to yours and you don't speak the same language. What does that tend to do? Oh, war. Hardly anybody can expand at all without getting into war. Well, verse 9, therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. There's a humorous wordplay here between the Sumerian word Babalu, which literally means gates of the god, and became the word from which was taken Babylon. The Sumerian word Babalu and the Hebrew word Babel, meaning chaotic confusion. So I guess it tends to color the name Babylon, whether you're a Sumerian or a Hebrew. But when the Lord caused this confusion, this babel of tongues, he effectively made it very difficult for people to get along. I mean, you know, it's not that he made them meaner. He didn't really need to do that. Did you ever wonder what that looked like? I mean, they're working on the tower, and everybody started speaking in different tongues.
Say, Bill, give me that drill over there, would you?
What do you do with that? How do you do that?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, Bill. Mike.
Well, miss yourself. But take off roots with it. Miss yourself.
Dude, chill. You can go on and on. This whole crew, all of a sudden.
What's with that, Tomas? I'll be a kid. Bonnetkov, Pishkinetsen, eh?
I was waiting for you, man. Thanks. But honestly, it happened like that. It happened like that. This guy you've been working with for 20 years, and now he doesn't even pronounce his name in a way you'd recognize it. Can you imagine the chaos just getting off the job site? Getting back your borrowed tools? Clocking your time card out? It was a nightmare. No wonder everybody took off. And what's interesting is they went, according to their tribes and languages, after they finally found other people that talked the way they did, they went to the places God selected for them. Now, you can read that in Deuteronomy. We shared that. Paul even said so to the guys in the Agora in Acts 17 from last week. Well, it is fascinating. It has kept a one global order from arising in the millennia that have transpired since then, at least until recently. It's fascinating to consider the last century or two. We've seen so many advances in technology and in communication. It's almost beginning to feel a little bit like we're back on the plains of Shinar here. If you consider the global dominance of the English language, it is the language of economics. It is the language of science. It is the language of aviation, pilots from every nation speak English. You must speak English to move in the airspaces of Europe, the United States, and most of the other continents. Even the universal application of mathematics. So now we've come far enough so that we're splitting atoms, we're sending men and women into space, we're developing robotics, and we're toying with artificial intelligence to outfit them with. You guys are aware that we have cloned living beings, right? Cows, sheep, dogs. How far do you think we are from cloning people? Do you think we've learned our lesson? No, we're starting to use the languages that we share to combine our ambition, our selfishness, our desire for power, our desire for knowledge, our desire for a lot of things. And we're really going at it, warp nine, as quickly as we can. You know, in Switzerland, near Geneva, that's where John Calvin once clarified the biblical principles that undergird the Protestant faith. Actually, all the Christian faith. But he really did some good work there. Well, now, very near Geneva, just a couple miles away, there's a huge underground racetrack. It's about 17 miles in diameter. It's about 600 feet underground. And it's run by a bunch of scientists who use it to accelerate subatomic particles right up to the point where they're almost at the speed of light, and then they smash them into each other to see what'll happen. Gosh, I wish they'd had chemistry sets when I was a kid that would do that. That really would have been cool. But they did not, and it's probably good. They recently discovered, I don't know if you're paying attention, something called the Higgs boson. That was on the 4th of July, 2012, a fundamental element that they'd been searching for ages, decades and decades, physicists been looking. It's actually a fundamental element that seems to be responsible, well, it serves as sort of a glue that holds the universe together. The other name they have for the Higgs boson is the God particle. Now, you've heard about that in the news. Okay, well, these scientists from nearly 30 European nations are hot on the trail discovering what makes the cosmos tick. Now, a lot of people are weirded out by this, but they keep reassuring everybody, no, we got it under control, it's okay. Well, I just discovered a week or two ago that in the courtyard at the entrance to the main building of the Large Hadron Collider stands a 10-foot bronze statue of Shiva, the Hindu god that many Hindus call the destroyer. Okay, it was a gift from the Indian government. They didn't want to hurt their feelings, so they put it right in the middle of everything. I can't help but kind of wonder the connection. Are you guys okay? Have you examined your motives here? It's just very interesting that they would choose to have that as their symbol. Well, the Tower of Babel is an interesting story, and it's a story that I don't think is over yet. I think it's more like the tide coming in and going out. It looks like a cycle in which we achieve a certain degree of expertise, a certain degree of communication amongst ourselves. And when enough of us speak the same language and combine our ambition, our hubris, our sin to move in a common direction against God's will, well, stuff's going to happen. I mean, it is. And this just adds to my conviction that we probably don't have too many centuries left before something exciting happens. But let's just leave that for now. That's the story of the Tower of Babel, the building of the tower, the confounding of the languages, the scattering of the nations that we actually read about in chapter 10. But let's retreat to a much more cheerful topic. Let's look at Shem's other line of descendants, which is the second part of chapter 11. Starting in verse 10, these are the records of the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and became the father of Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived 500 years after he became the father of Arpachshad, and he had other sons and daughters. They included that just to show how strong and virile these guys were. They could have as many children as they wanted. 500 years. And Arpachshad lived 35 years and became the father of Shelah. That could actually be short for the name Methuselah. Is it the same guy? We have no idea. It's just the timing is interesting, though. Could be a fun coincidence. This is why I can't wait to get into the father's DVD library when we get home. Oh my goodness. And Arpachshad lived 403 years after he became the father of Shelah, and he had other sons and daughters. And Shelah lived 30 years, became the father of Eber. And Shelah lived 403 years after he became the father of Eber, and he had other sons and daughters. And Eber lived 34 years and became the father of Peleg. Now, I'm just going to read one or two verses from chapter 10 last week, just to remind you. In verse 21, when we were introducing the genealogy of Shem, Noah's son, it said, "And also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber." So even in that genealogy, the author wants to draw our attention. Oh, wait, this is the guy. This is the guy. Don't forget about him. We're going to talk about him later. All the children of Eber, and then a couple verses later, and two sons were born to Eber. The name of the one was Peleg, which means division, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Now, division, referencing Peleg's name as division, this is not just division as in the scattering of the nations. Lord knows that was division enough. But it's also division in the separating of Peleg's two lines, of Eber's two lines, one to Peleg and one to Joktan. Because Joktan just kind of bottomed out. He and his descendants took off, headed east with everybody else, probably got involved with this mess of building the Tower of Babel, and ended up settling in Yemen or Oman in southern Arabia. So not really high-class neighborhoods, but that's where they ended up. But the second son, verse 17, and Eber lived 430 years after he became the father of Peleg, and he had other sons and daughters. Peleg lived 30 years and became the father of Reu. And Peleg lived 209 years after he became the father of Reu, and he had other sons and daughters. Do you notice the lifespans are kind of precipitously dropping here? Hold on to that thought. And Reu lived 32 years, became the father of Serug. And Reu lived 207 years after he became the father of Serug and had other sons and daughters. And Serug lived 30 years and became the father of Nahor. And Serug lived 200 years after he became the father of Nahor. He had other sons and daughters. Nahor lived 29 years and became the father of Terah. And Nahor lived 119 years after he became the father of Terah. And he had other sons and daughters. And Terah lived 70 years and became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, I couldn't help, just for fun, getting my calculator out. Again, if we could apply this genealogy exactly as it's written and trust that they got every name and all of the year-by-year intervals were exactly correct, it would mean that Abraham was born 292 years after the flood, or 292 AF, as I like to think of it. Not only that, until he was 33 years old, which was the year Peleg died, until Abraham was 33 years old, every one of his ancestors, all the way back to great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather Shem, were still walking around on the earth, talking and sowing crops, and they were all there. Gosh, those family reunions must have been exciting. At least a lot of good stories. Okay. Sadly, again, I have to say our best evidence, which is the open genealogies of the ancient times. They just did not feel a compulsion to be exhaustively complete or exact in some of their intervals. We're going to guess, we postulate, maybe a 1,500 years may have separated separated Abraham from the flood. But again, that would be the right amount of time, and it would fit the evidence we have. And you guys, it's okay to fit with the evidence you've got. You know, in seminary, they always tell us, you know, interpret Scripture literally every place you can. And every once in a while, you run into a spot where obviously, you know, the Lord's eye doesn't actually literally move across the planet because he's spirit. Or when he's rolling up his sleeves to get some work done. So obviously there are some symbolic interpretations. And here too, you know, this is a big thing even among Christians, you know, is it a literal, you know, 7 days of creation and 6,000 year interval, you know, or do those represent eras? You know, I don't know. I'll meet you at the DVD library, okay? When we get home, we'll find out for sure. But the fact is, you are allowed to apply the evidence. And in applying the evidence, feel very confident that when you read the Bible and the creation account, if you understand the truth in that way, man, you are right on the money. You know, whether it differed a couple hours or days or this or that, don't worry. God created everything from nothing in an instant. And he created you and I from dirt and water. That's the truth. And when we meet at the DVD library, you will discover that it's the truth. So rest in that now. I mean, remember his audience. Who is he talking to? I mean, you know, bean farmers and camel jockeys and people like that. This does not need to be a compendium of astrophysics, which we demand today. So when you read these accounts, relax. Rest in them. Trust them. By all means, you want to do the research, go to it. It's fun. It's exhausting, but it really is fun. It's fun to catch up on physics. They're proving the biblical accounts faster than we possibly could, the physicists. I don't even want to take the time to share with you some of the fun things they're discovering. But it seems that God's description given to us in Scripture is exactly the way this place is built. Enough said. Oh, I might add, just for fun, that the 5,000-year-old Sumerian list of kings also records not only the flood, but that same logarithmic reduction in lifespans. I've heard several theories forwarded on why this might be, that the flood itself changed the composition and character of the atmosphere, the moisture content, the amount of ultraviolet light getting through, which would do a job on you. You know, you're used to living 500 years and you get sunburned a few times. That's going to knock you off about 200 years. Relax. Yes, barometric pressure, atmospheric pressure. There's a ton of ways this could have happened. But the Bible is not responsible for giving us all the scientific information. It just gives us the direction to go. Okay, now these are the records of the generations of Terah. Terah became, verse 27, became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran became the father of Lot. And Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldees. Okay. Ur of the Chaldees, we're pretty certain, is a harbor city at the bottom of the Euphrates River. It's right on the Persian Gulf. It's on the south bank of the Euphrates, probably about 65,000 people. Archaeologists have suggested it was the largest city on the planet in 2000 BC. They're not aware of any city that is bigger than that at that time. So that's where they are. That's where they leave. Although now it's been silted up, it's something like 19 miles from the Persian coast. It just, you know, the river, it just carries down the silt, and before you know it, same thing happened to Ephesus. If you ever get a chance to go there. Let's see, 29. And Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. And Sarai was barren. She had no child. We'll talk more about that in the weeks to come. We'll also talk about why did the names change? Why did Sarai become Sarah? Why did Abram become Abraham? And those are honorifics given to honorable older people, and we'll talk more about it. Verse 31, and Terah took Abram his son and Lot the son of Haran, his now orphaned grandson, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldees in order to enter the land of Canaan. And they went as far as Haran and settled there. Just coincidence that it's the name of his dead son. Haran was an important merchant city located in upper Mesopotamia as you head up towards Turkey to the northwest between the two rivers. It's actually situated between the two rivers, so it was on the road between Antioch, a bustling merchant town, and Babylon. So, man, it was a caravan crossroads, and they taxed the spiferifics out of every camel that went through there. So they were very rich, so it was a good place to stop. Now, just for fun, if you picture the map, also please remember, if he's going to enter the land of Canaan, does he want to take a straight line from the Persian Gulf? What will that get him into? The deadly thousand-mile-wide salt pan of the great desert, where he'll die. So they go the long way following the rivers around. That's why they call it the Fertile Crescent, remember? And they get about halfway and say, well, Haran's a nice place. Let's dig in. Let's rest. And so they do. You know, I do have to wonder, though, as I was reading this, what got into Terah's mind that made him want to seek out Canaan? Doesn't say. I mean, Abraham got the call. God specifically said, dude, we're out of here. Come on, Canaan. But what about Terah? It just doesn't say. Verse 32, the last verse, and the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So there's Abe, there's Sarai, there's all their kin in Haran. They're probably making a pretty good living. They apparently are idol worshipers, found about 3 or 4 spots where the whole family, you know, that's what you do. They worship idols. So that's the situation when we open our scene next week, when the patriarchal history of Genesis really gears down and starts picking up steam. But just for now, you know, I'm reading through this. These general stories, you know, the Table of Nations and things like that, it's harder to get things to give you guys as a takeaway from these. You know, what we call application, the principles, the things that, the lessons to be learned, the things that you take away to change your behavior. So on these big ones, sometimes I find that they end up kind of being general and they end up repeating a lot. And all I can think of every time I read them is, well, I actually need to hear them repeated a lot because I don't follow these very as well as I really should. So I feel almost no guilt in burdening you with applications that you may have heard before. The first, I'd like to say, just given the example of all the sons of Noah, not counting Peleg's line, the first thing I'd like to remind you of is I'd encourage you to hesitate to trust yourself. I don't mean ignore your thoughts or conclusions. I don't mean abandon them. But where people get into trouble, where the 70 nations got into trouble, just like Adam and Eve, is where they really equate their own understanding with reality. So I guess I'm just asking you guys to consider how vulnerable you and I are to being fooled. I don't know. Have you ever misunderstood something somebody said or did, got mad at them, yelled at them, and then discovered later you're a complete idiot, that you completely misunderstood what they were saying? You know, it's actually something in the mission field we call misattribution. And it's critical as you go into the mission field that you put a speed bump in front of that, because you're going to encounter stuff that'll absolutely blow your mind. And if you react thinking that this person means the same thing, like when somebody in the Middle East does this to you, does that make you feel good? Well, if I do it to you, it makes you feel good, right? Because I'm saying, dude, right on, excellent. It's not a good thing in the Middle East. It's a bad thing in the Middle East. And that's just one of a thousand. I have a book, The Best Means of Curses, Insults, and Swear Words in 50 Cultures. I think it's a Rick Steves thing, but I found it somewhere. I'm not even sure I've read it yet, but it was so fascinating, I couldn't resist. I'll bring it next week. I'll show it to you guys, okay? But just that, just understanding, when you have a conclusion, you have a thought, it's valuable, hold on to it. Very often, your decision on whether or not to take an umbrella to work today will bear fruit. But please remember that it may or may not represent reality. Just have some humility about that. I did manage to find a Bible verse that actually addresses this. In Proverbs 3, 5 to 8, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, he will make your path straight. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn from evil. It will be healing to your body and refreshment to your bones. There were so many verses. We could be here for like hours. What do you think? Shall we? Yeah. Let's look at them. I do have one I want to share with you guys. It's in Isaiah 11. It's talking about, I think I've shared this before. Let's see, Old Testament, right? I've shared it before. It's one of the messianic prophecies. And it may surprise you. I mean, we always turn to chapter 9 and some of the others. But here in Isaiah 11, there shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, speaking of a descendant of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. Who are we talking about? Yeah, Jesus. And he shall not judge by what his eyes see, or decide disputes by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. I just want to let it stir in your minds that even Jesus does not lean on his own understanding. And if Jesus doesn't trust what his eyes and ears and senses and understanding give him, really, that's an indicator that maybe we shouldn't either. Well, if hesitating to trust yourself, I'd say goes hand in hand with Micah 6:8, one of my favorite verses, where basically tells you to love justice, but more importantly, it says, walk humbly with your God. We don't understand in our culture very much what humility means. I mean, we think it means being a doormat, let people use you and abuse you. No, it doesn't. It's actually quite a holy thing. It means letting go of your agenda because you trust God's agenda even more, which is much easier said than done. For all these things, Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is saying, for all these things the Gentiles eagerly seek, but your heavenly Father knows you need them. So seek first his kingdom, his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. That's in Matt 6. We've heard it 1,000 times before. But I found a good... Rick is always making us read books, us elders. That guy. But I found this one was a really good one. And it's Gordon Smith. It's Hearing the Voice of Jesus. And I just want to share one little quote from him. And he's talking about just discerning God, discerning God's voice. How do you tell the difference? This is what he says. Humility is critical. The spiritual exercises, that was a book written by Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits. The spiritual exercises include a word that expresses the hope of humility for which we all long. Indifference. Let that sink in for a second. Indifference. Holy indifference is not apathy. It is rather the inner posture of freedom where we are able to say and feel that we are open to whatever God wills. If God gives wealth, that is good. If God withholds wealth, that is good. If God grants us the position for which we've applied, that is good. If God grants it to another, that is good as well. We are indifferent. It's not that we do not care, but we've chosen to place our hopes and longings in God. And come what may, we will be content with how and what God provides. It also means that we will trust God to do his work in his time. Holy indifference means I have no investment in how this turns out. You know what? This really spoke to my heart because this isn't the key in ministry. We do so much stuff. You guys do too. You know, you pour things into your unbelieving relatives and loved ones, and you're just thinking, oh, well, this is never going to bear fruit. But you keep doing it. And my gosh, one day, they want to come to the Lord. Or something else happens. You just, 10 years later, you see why he let you break your leg in that skiing accident. Right now, I'm kind of wondering what good it is when my property tax, I just opened and it went up 9.3%. But I know he's got a plan. I know something good. Okay, I'm just thankful I had the money to pay it. Holy indifference. It really lifts you out of the snake pit of fear. That is how we so often respond to the challenges and the scary things of life. Cultivate holy indifference. And remember that to him who's able to do exceedingly, abundantly, beyond all that we ask or think, according to the power that works within us, to him be the glory in the church and in Christ Jesus to all generations, forever and ever. So hesitate to trust yourself. Walk humbly with your God. Trust his agenda. And the last one you've only heard a million times, choose who you can trust. You know, guys, 1,000 times a day, you have a choice. Things happen, problems arise, challenges dig into you. You want to figure out what do you say? How do you respond? Where do you return? The critical choice lies in the version of reality that you choose to believe. If you believe what you see and hear, if you believe as if they were the gospel, the conclusions of your own mind, you're going to be in bad shape. Because it's scary. It's painful. It's grief-stricken. This is not Disneyland, this place. This is an ugly place. And it's rapidly getting worse. So somehow, in order to see things the way they really are, you need to do something else. We laughingly at PBC call this choice worldview. And it's something we do unconsciously. I mean, a lot of people watch PBC, or a lot of people watch CNN or Fox or the internet, and they don't filter it. It just goes in. Oh, well, that's what's going on. Or TV or reality shows, or what the neighbor says, or what they think. Maybe what the scientists at the Large Hadron Collider say, if their version of reality is yours. You really have to choose 1,000 times a day whose version of reality is trustworthy. Who's not lying to you? Who's telling you the truth? Who loves you enough to tell you what's really going on? There's only one guy. There's only one guy that loves you that much. But you have to choose to believe him. And I fail 1,000 times a day. I look at us whizzing up and down Highway 62, trying hard not to shoot people in the Costco parking lot, opening my property tax statement. I mean, there's 1,000 times a day when I've got a good reason, I think, not to trust God's version of reality. But it always makes me unhappy. I get mad, I get cranky, I get sad, I get tired, I get discouraged. Let it go. If you choose to receive the reality that Christ has affirmed and created and revealed to your heart and your spirit, you're golden. You're golden. And if you haven't, it's just a matter of seconds for you to say, please, God, I'm an idiot. I don't want to be. I want to know what's going on. Please tell me what's going on. Please share with me. Please help me do this right. It's not fancy, but he will answer that prayer every time. He loves you, and he wants you to get it. You know, in John 6:29, the Lord summed it up pretty well. Everything we have to worry about, he said, this is the work of God. Believe in him whom he has sent. End of story. Heavenly Father, Lord, the things you tell us, we know they seem easy when we talk about them, but boy, are they difficult to get into the habit of thinking the way you do. Please help us, Lord. Please give us strength. Please forgive the endless failures. Please be patient with how long this takes us. Please take pleasure in every little microscopic gain of learning, of maturing, of growing in you. We seek so much, Father, to be a pure and unadulterated pleasure to you, and in Christ I know we are. We thank you for that. But we want to bat 1,000 down here. Please help us. Please inhabit our conversation, our thoughts, our devotions, correct our mistakes, and grant we may grow every day to be more and more the image of your Son, in whose name we offer you our hearts and thanks. Amen.